kind of to start off, my thought is we're in about stage three of coping with this situation. We've gone through the initial hunt for paper towels, sanitizer. Tiger King is in the rear view, but we're still trying to figure out if maybe he was involved or not. We're all about 2 weeks away from deciding the extent to which our lives are going to be better once we all break free of this. So we've got that to look forward to. But here's where the FFCRA, and we are going to shorten it. We're generally not in love with acronyms, but we'll get that rolling. FFCRA, Family First Coronavirus Response Act. It just came in 2 weeks back. We're now there's really two big aspects to this. We'll break them apart. There's what we call the Emergency Paid Sick Leave Act and then the Emergency Family and Medical Leave Expansion Act. So there's some fairly lengthy acronyms coming up from that. The big picture of the way these two programs work together is to really expand the various types of leave and the financial avenues that are existing for people who are either forced out of work due to their own illnesses, quarantine directives from health providers, and a lot of it actually is childcare driven. You'll see a lot of that as we go along. So we want to first look at the emergency paid sick leave. I'll focus on that. Rachel will get into more of the family and medical leave issues in a few minutes here. Big picture for Emergency Paid Sick Leave Act. 2 paid weeks of sick leave to everybody under every employee when the employer has under 500 employees. Keeping in mind, there are some separate local programs that require this to be followed within LA, even if you have over 500 employees. I don't suspect there's a huge number of people on the call with us today who are from employers of more than 500 people, but obviously if there are, they're going to want to look and see what's eligible. So again, most people in the country don't work for employers over 500, so this will be most folks. Generally speaking, there are some pretty limited exemptions, namely if you can show that it will jeopardize the business, but even that's only tied in with childcare related issues. Because again, what is driving a lot of this is the idea that people with coronavirus who may be either infected or may be a carrier and could put others at risk, we want to get these folks out of the workplace on a temporary basis, right? We don't want to have scenarios where people, due to financial distress, are forced to continually show up for work, let their health decline, and then make the rest of their coworkers similarly affected. So that's what drives a lot of this, and what you're going to see is kind of the thread. Emergency paid sick leave has 6 primary eligibility standards. We'll go through them quickly. They kind of break down into 2 real different blocks. Number 1, the employee subject to a federal, state, or local quarantine or isolation order. 2, the employee's been advised by a healthcare provider that they must self-quarantine. You stay home, you are at risk of making yourself worse or infecting your coworkers in the community around you. 3, employees experiencing symptoms of COVID and is looking for a diagnosis. That's that scenario we've seen a few times where, someone is feeling poor, they're trying to get a test or they're waiting for test results to come back. We don't want them showing up for work every day, waiting for the other shoe to drop to find out, oh yeah, it was COVID all along and you've spread it to 4 more people. Number 4 is where things change a little bit. It's where you're caring for someone else that's affected by 1 or 2. That is to basically say a family member, roommate, child, et cetera, who is affected by it. And that's in a really important distinction here. Number 5 is where this starts to creep into some of our other family leave protocols. But the idea is, you're caring for a son or a daughter whose school or place of care has been closed or the child care provider is unavailable. Okay, this is not people with a child that is ailing. This is one who can't go to where they normally stay during the day when mom and dad go to work. And so you have to find someone to stay home to take care of them. That has a little bit different caveat we'll add to it. Number 6 is kind of an oddball. The employee has some condition which is similar to COVID. Frankly, the federal government hasn't actually explained what they mean by that. My thought would be basically, you know, we talk about this being COVID-19. Probably it's a scenario where there's a mutation of this and we get COVID-20, or we get some variation which is sort of similar to it or has some kind of overlapping aspect. And we don't want to take such a narrow view on this or have to pass new legislation to say, well, we need to start from scratch, get all of the everybody back to Washington to pass the same thing twice for COVID-20 or some aspect along those lines. One of the big issues that comes up has been, how do we interpret this quarantine and stay at home together? Because this is a pretty common question. If I am directed by the governor, by my boss, to stay at home because it's better, does that entitle me to sick leave pay under this legislation? The short answer is probably not. And the reason being, you have to really, and I want to go back to, let me go back to the list. This matters. If you look at these aspects of the first three, it really comes down to saying, what's the first two words? The employee is subject to a federal or state. The employee has been advised. This is not to say the employee works for an employer subject to an isolation order. That's not the case. And that's why when we look at this stay-at-home issue, it really focuses on the idea of, if you are not affected directly by this, in the sense of you are not ill, you have not been directed to stay home, you are not, generally speaking, going to be eligible. And that is the case even if your place of work has been shut down on a stay, on an isolation order from the county. We've seen that of the governor. If that's the situation and your employer says everyone needs to go home, or you find a scenario where, you know, you work for a coffee shop and nobody wants to go to the coffee shop when they're in the middle of a pandemic, so business dries up and they just decide, let's go home, that also is not going to be generating eligibility for sick leave pay. That could and probably would enable you to get unemployment benefits, but sick leave is not going to fall simply from kind of external factors when you are, again, not actually carrying the virus or believed to be in that situation. There may be other scenarios where you're caring for someone else, but this is one that comes up very commonly. All right, so how do we look at the pay? Obviously, this is a sick leave pay legislation. For those 2 weeks, if you are under 1, 2, or 3, which is to say you are directed by the governor or your health provider to stay home, you have it, or you're waiting for a test result, you've got two paid weeks of sick pay at your standard rate of pay for your regular schedule. So if that's $200 a day, you get paid $200 a day for those 2 weeks. There is a cap on this at $511 per day. And if you extrapolate that out, 5 workdays times 2 weeks, that's 10 workdays. That's why you see the 511 times 10 is $5,110. It's not a huge amount of money that we're talking here. Again, it's only 2 weeks of pay. It's better than nothing. But after that, there may be some other issues that come up. For leave reasons 4 or 6, that is either taking care of a, let's bring that back, just to refresh, you are caring for an individual who's subject to one of those two orders, or you've been advised to stay at home, or you have this kind of oddball condition that we don't know about, that's 2/3 the regular rate of pay. Or if you make 2/3 the minimum wage, that'll be fine. Up to $200 per day and $2,000 in the aggregate. There are policy reasons why that's lesser. I mean, my personal take is we don't want to have a scenario where people could theoretically be choosing to work but are deciding to take care of family members instead. The federal government always wants to get people who can work back to work. That's just kind of the nature of how these things go. They want to make sure that if there's someone who can be working, that's happening. The other one, which is interesting, and this overlaps with what Rachel's going to be talking about in a few minutes, is the expanded FMLA. It's still that 2/3 rate of the regular pay, capped at $200. That actually extends out for a much longer time period. That can actually go 12 weeks. So that's a different one. And again, there are certain reasons why that's the situation. But again, if you are staying home, oddly enough, not because anyone's ill, but because the kids are home from some type of situation where school's shut down, babysitter's ill, whatever, you actually have that lengthier period of time. The other aspect of that too is, as we said before, it's only 2/3 the regular rate of pay. So it's markedly different. And separately, it's they want to give you a good reason to get back to work. And again, not have everybody try to stay home because they want to have everybody a reason to get back out there. That's just kind of one way to look at it. Employees, how does this work? You may not be required to use other forms of PTO first. That is to say, you can't make the employees take all of their vacation time before they begin to get into that pay. Those two, just for the sick leave, that is. There's a little bit of a different situation when it comes to the FMLA. We'll get to that in a few moments. They don't have to find their own coverage. If they are ill or need to go get tested or a doctor has directed them to stay at home, they don't have to go find their replacement. That's not required. You can't make them do it. If you do, you're violating the Fair Labor Standards Act. Separately, when we look at the amount of that, how we calculate the hours to be paid, full-time employees working 40 hours get 40 hours per week. Makes sense. 40 times 2 is 80. Part-time employees have their standard two-week provision. That is to say, if I work 30 hours a week, I will get 30 hours the first, 30 hours the second. One thing to note, which is kind of interesting about the way this works, is that if someone consistently works more than 40 hours, if I have a traditional overtime type schedule where I work, say, 50 hours, I'm still capped at the 80 hours of paid leave. So in week one, I'd be paid for 50 hours, and then week two, paid for 30. So there's something, a little bit of an accounting issue to stay on top of, because it's a little bit unorthodox the way you normally see that. What are our documentation steps look like? And I'll tell you why this is going to be important in a minute, namely because you need to make sure you get reimbursed for this. Every employer has to do the following. No matter what happens, you need to keep, if someone comes in and asks for the expanded family or medical leave or paid sick leave, you need to record why. Who is it? What are they requesting? Why are they asking for the time? And then they need to verify that they believe they can't work for that purpose. Similarly, if there's information where someone's taking time away from work because of the school closing, we see that very commonly, you need to record certain information. Who's the kid? What's the school or daycare provider, and a statement from them. You are not required and should not ask them for a diagnosis. You should not ask them you don't even really need a medical certification for paid sick leave. You might need it for FMLA, that's a little different, but do not make them bring in a doctor's note. That is not required, that's not necessary. And for this purpose, you're really barking up the wrong tree. You're just giving people a hard time when you want to have them get away from the workplace as soon as possible if they may be contaminating everyone who's there. So they got to be careful about that. This is not the time, from my stance, to be a stickler on these things. Those records you want to hold on to for 4 years. So keep that, tuck it in a file, scan it, and hold on to it because you're going to need it down the road. Biggest reason is you can get tax credits on this. If you are giving emergency paid sick leave, the expanded FMLA, which we'll talk about in a couple minutes, you can get that money back. It's sort of a defer. They don't just cut you a big check, but you can get that credited back against the employer's portion of the Social Security taxes. You get it 100% back. So this is actually going to be better than any kind of vacation pay that you normally would be awarding. Federal government basically is saying, hey, we're making you do this, so we're not going to have you take the big hit on it. So that's good. So that's why the record keeping is so important, because if there's ever a scenario where you are asked to provide documentation and certification as to what happened and you don't have anything from the employees or any explanation for why you are not paying your Social Security taxes timely and properly, that's the situation. You're going to need those records. So you don't want to go after the fact looking to hunt and get that stuff when, you know, 6 months from now or when you're trying to run your taxes in the future. Again, tax credits are capped at the amount per person. So again, you can't be paying $512 rather per day. And if it's someone else, it's the $200 credit. One sort of caveat on this I want to talk about briefly is the newer City of LA supplemental paid sick leave. It's looking like this is going to come into effect right now. It was passed by part of the city government last week. I'm not sure if the mayor signed it, but that's likely going to be happening any day now. So keep an eye on that. It just basically extends, the real functionality here is it extends these types of protections and leave pay allowances to employers with more than 500 employees who would have been otherwise excluded under FFCRA. So it kind of expands out what the law will take for those larger employers who are otherwise exempted. I don't know why entirely they were excluded from the first time round, but the City of LA has decided that if you are going to do business in this city, you are going to enable the FFCRA to apply in functionality, if not technically. A little bit of a 30-day eligibility standard, but again, follow-up if that matters to you. So we'll switch over now to the And by the way, we'll kind of go back and discuss questions on this and the other, but let's switch over now to the Emergency Family Medical Leave Expansion Act. That's a lot of verbiage there.
All right, so I'm going to be talking about which I may refer to as emergency or expanded FMLA. And it's important to note that it provides additional paid sick leave necessary to care for an employee's child whose school or place of care is closed or child care provider is unavailable due to COVID-19. So this basically only applies to number 5 of the 6 that Tristan went over earlier. So you can only get the expanded FMLA leave for that reason. There's unpaid leave for the first 2 weeks. And so that's typically gonna be during the time that the Emergency Paid Sick Leave Act of 2 weeks of pay is going to be in effect. So then those 2 weeks are not going to be paid also under the expanded FMLA. So it extends thereafter for 10 weeks paid. So after those first 2 weeks, the next 10 are going to be paid. However, it's only going to be paid at 2/3 of the regular rate of pay, which we'll get to in a bit, for hours normally scheduled to work over the subsequent 10 weeks. Something that's different about the expanded FMLA Act is that it requires you to pay an employee for hours the employee would have been normally scheduled to work, even if that is more than 40 hours in 1 week. Also, an employee is eligible if they have worked for more than 30 days as of the date that they want to begin their leave, which is a much lower requirement than under regular FMLA.
Yeah, if you will remember, for standard FMLA, the leave available to a person requires a full year of employment and 1,250 hours of actual work. That does not apply here. It's a really dramatic change. It's only 30 days before you're eligible for this. Again, it's a more narrow scope than FMLA because it's related to just childcare, but you have a much quicker turnaround for people being eligible. Mm-hmm. And the other aspect of it too is, although it's sort of can be viewed as an extension and an expansion of FMLA, the regular, what we'll call normal FMLA, does not now suddenly become paid. FMLA leave traditionally is unpaid. This doesn't alter that. So it's just this one caveat of one specific type of leave, which is going to be subject to that.
All right. And this applies to employers also with under 500 employees. You count part-time and full-time employees into that number to determine whether you have 500 employees.
Right. We're not getting into full-time equivalents and part-timers who work stacked. If they're on your roster, they count.
Right. And then you must count also all employees within the United States at the time the employee would take leave, within the United States means employees within any state of the United States, the District of Columbia, or any territory or possession of the United States. You also count employees currently employed together with any employees that have been put on leave of any kind or have gone out on leave. And then employees that are jointly employed, for instance, let's say you have a staffing agency, you also need to count those. You would not count independent contractors, workers who have been laid off and not been subsequently reemployed, or workers who have been furloughed and not subsequently reemployed.
All right, we're going to get into the math section of the program here. So,
all right. So earlier, Tristan mentioned the regular rate of pay. And the way to calculate that, and also it's been clearly defined on the U.S. Department of Labor website, is basically you're going to take the higher of the employee's regular rate or the state federal minimum wage. So typically, it's going to be the regular rate that you're going to go by. And to determine that, you're going to take each full work week in which the employee has been employed over the previous 6 months, or if the employee has been employed for less than 6 months over the entire period of employment, you're going to exclude overtime from that calculation and basically just count the number of hours that have been worked that don't include the overtime hours. We'll get to an example in a second, but what you're going to do is you're going to average out each of those weeks to then get the average regular rate.
Right. So along those lines, the idea is you want to weight it so that if you have the same person working the same rate throughout, life is easy. This is no problem on this. Things are pretty smooth. The problem is when you have people working on a changing rate of pay, or they're seeing pay rates or there's other things that factor into that. You want to weight it so that the number of hours for each pay rate are given more emphasis. That is to say, if I work 10 hours at $20 an hour and I work 1 hour at $10 an hour, it shouldn't just be split the difference between 10 and 20 and 10. It's really going to be a lot closer to 20 by the time you run the numbers, because that's really more reflective of what the actual pay rate really is. So, sorry, go ahead.
So as an example, let's say you have an employee that received $400 in non-excludable compensation in 1 week for working 40 hours, and that the same employee also received $200 of non-excludable compensation in the next week for working 10 hours. So the way you would calculate regular rate for the first week would be you would take the $400 and divide it by 40 hours to get $10 per hour. For the second week, where the employee earned $200, you would divide that by 10, and you get $20 per hour. And so then the weighted average would be the $600, where you total together the amount of pay the worker received, divided by the sum of all hours worked, which would be 50 hours. So the regular rate for the 2 week period would be $12 per hour. All right, so we would also need to determine the scheduled number of hours. So basically, if the employee has a normal work schedule, then that means the number of hours the employee is normally scheduled to work on that workday. If the employee has a variable work schedule and has been employed for at least 6 months, the scheduled number of hours means the average number of hours the employee was scheduled to work each workday over the previous 6 months. If the employee has a variable work schedule and has been employed for less than 6 months, however, the scheduled number of hours is going to be the average number of hours the employee and the employer agreed at the time of hiring the employee that they would be working each workday. And if there's no such agreement, then the scheduled number of hours is equal to the average number of hours per workday that the employee was scheduled to work over the entire period of employment.
Right. So just to kind of simplify that a little bit, if someone's working, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, 8 hours, you could pretty consistently just kind of evaluate that as 24 hours a week and go, without much of a question on. That's pretty easy. This is really coming up when we're doing the averaging is when it changes, and it's, 20 hours 1 week, 25 the next, 30 the next, 15 the next, and it's just kind of all over the place. If you work for 6 months, we'll take the 6 months. If they've only been there 4 months, we'll look at 4 months. You try to do the best you can. It's really just to get a sense as to what's the best picture of what's been happening over a fairly lengthy period of time.
And the reason it's important is because after those first 2 weeks of emergency or expanded FMLA leave, during those remaining 10 weeks, the employee is going to be paid at 2/3 of the regular rate of pay for the hours normally scheduled. And if not normally scheduled, then you have to go by the analysis that we just used to get their scheduled hours. So that's why you would need to determine both the scheduled hours and the regular rate of pay so that you could correctly calculate the 2/3 of that so that the employee can be compensated.
So we're going to switch now to some kind of questions that tend to come up, and we'll talk about them specifically, but then highlight kind of how they get into some broader issues. So do you want to go through the first?
Sure. Okay, so one of the common questions is, if the employer closes the work site with a person on paid sick leave or expanded family and medical leave, what happens? Well, in that scenario, the employer must pay for any paid sick leave or expanded family and medical leave used before the employer closed down. And as of the date the employer closes the work site, then the employer is no longer entitled to paid sick leave or expanded family medical leave, but the employee can be eligible potentially for unemployment insurance benefits. And this is true whether the employer closes the worksite because of lack of business or because the employer was required to close pursuant to a federal, state, or local directive, such as not being an essential business and, for instance, maybe not being able to do telework.
Yeah. What's important with that and why we raise it is because it highlights the important issue here, which is, why is it that the person isn't working? And if the situation is I go off on, and then kind of compare it to, were I to be healthy, then what would happen? You know, generally speaking, if you, under the first six examples we looked at, there's some variation of I cannot work because I am ill, I am subject my personal self to a quarantine, something like that. Ergo, I am removed from the workplace, even if the workplace is rolling along. On the other hand, if the workplace has shut down due to a stay-at-home or because it's currently a non-essential business or because no one wants to go to a coffee shop in a pandemic, then no matter what my health status was, I would not be there. I would be home because, the business is closed indefinitely. So you aren't going to get the benefit of paid sick leave if it wouldn't have actually made a difference due to external factors like the shut stay-at-home orders, those types of things. So that's really what you want to keep looking for when you have multiple things going on at once. Would the business actually be operating that the person could work even if they were healthy? I'll read that, so just because I'm not going. So may the employer use the paid sick leave mandated under the Emergency Paid Sick Leave Act to satisfy paid leave requirements that an employee may have under your own paid leave policy? The answer is no. That is to say, if I have accrued vacation time, paid leave, whatever, I can't make, I can't sort of substitute the vacation time someone would normally have, any kind of paid sick leave, PTO, I can't make them use that in lieu of the paid sick leave afforded to me. The idea being, this is a new benefit, frankly. This is new benefit money. This is a new opportunity for employees that did not exist. Part of the other reason, too, is because from a tax and accounting standpoint, if you are giving people paid sick leave, this is a standard form of of compensation. You're not getting a tax rebate and a Social Security offset. Meanwhile, paid sick leave does. So you don't get to get the benefit of giving people free vacation time when they normally would have had it, not for this leave. So it needs to be treated distinctly. Rich, why don't you go to the next one here?
All right, so Tristan quickly touched on this, but question that comes up is, does the expanded FMLA add more weeks if the employee already has used FMLA leave? And the answer is no. You get 12 weeks in total. However, the expanded paid sick leave, the Emergency Paid Sick Leave Act is separate and does not count towards the 12 weeks. But if you already used, for instance, 2 weeks of FMLA leave in that period, that year period, then you're only entitled to 10 weeks of the emergency FMLA leave.
Yeah, you're going to max out at 12 weeks. And if you've already taken 6 weeks away because you broke your leg and needed time away from that, you don't get 18 weeks total. You get another six, and that's fine. Again, emergency paid sick leave, you could add two more, but that's a different animal. We spoke a little bit earlier about small business exceptions, and that's a fairly limited thing. And I think sometimes people got a little bit too excited for how this may go. It is not for anyone that you don't want to let go, or you want to make sure they get to stay, that kind of thing. It is limited for the child care necessitated leave. Okay. That's if someone is having to do with the, the elements number five, basically. It's kind of the EFMLEA. So if you have under 50 employees and you really can't make it work where somebody walks out to, conduct childcare, you have to be able to show, if before you say we're exempt and you have to stay here, you have to be able to show that doing so would be so serious of a harm to the business that it would basically cease to even operate at a minimal capacity. Okay, that's a pretty serious issue. One other option is it would require paid sick leave that would create a substantial risk to the financial health and operational capacities of the business because of the specialized skills, knowledge, and responsibilities. That is to say, this is someone whose skills and experience and role in the organization are so essential to how this operates that you really can't let it go. Basically, this person walking out is going to bring the business to its knees in itself. And then finally, the other avenue which might apply is they're not sufficient workers who are able, willing, qualified to be able to time and place to perform what needs to be done. All of these kind of come back to the notion of if this person leaves, the business really can't function. I think it would be difficult to do that with one person leaving from a business of 50. Right. That's going to be a tough sell for an employer to say these things really apply. What really is more applicable is if you have a scenario where you have maybe 10 employees and three of them are going to go out the door, where you're so shorthanded, you really don't have the option to be able to, continue operating. It's a little bit of a narrow scope, and it puts a lot of burden on the business and the officers to show that. One other exception we haven't spoken about much to date is and pertains to the healthcare workers. Certain medical providers can exempt from the Family First Coronavirus Response Act healthcare workers. You got to be careful with that. I don't know how many healthcare providers we have on the call here now, but it's really narrow. You can do it if it's a good idea is a very different question. I'm not sure why forcing someone to continue to show up, when that situation is going to be helpful. But, we can deal with it that way later. But we don't generally trying to find exceptions for why you should make people show up for work in the middle of the pandemic is generally not a great long-term plan. Smear you.
I can do this.
Okay.
All right. So another question that comes up is, what if an employee unilaterally decides to self-quarantine without a diagnosis or medical advising to self-quarantine? Even if an employee is maybe, having a cough or something, they cannot take paid sick leave under the FFCRA if they unilaterally decide to self-quarantine for an illness without medical advice, even if you are having some symptoms of COVID-19. So you would basically need to seek medical advice in order to be entitled to that under number, is it two?
Three.
And
two or three.
But, something to keep in mind for employers is that there may be other FMLA factors present. So for instance, maybe the individual has some underlying condition where they would be entitled to FMLA separately, which would be unpaid. So that would be something to keep in mind. And
The other long-term factors, do you want to be the employer who is making people who say, I don't feel safe coming to work in the middle of this highly dangerous pandemic, and you're the boss or the employer who says, I don't care, I want you here Monday morning at 9. It's a tough, tough look for the employer to do that, particularly when they may be showing symptoms. I understand the notion that we want to keep people working, but you have to use a fair amount of judgment on this. Whether you theoretically could force someone to come to work isn't necessarily the question of should you do that. But technically, they can't just self-diagnose and say, I'm not coming to work, and I have to get paid straight through. So the pay versus the leave is a little different question.
And the Department of Labor has been clear about this and actually used this example on its website under the question and answers that they posted.
Yeah. And then, so the next one, we'll just kind of keep moving here. How broadly a childcare provider in place of care interpreted? Answers, very broadly, right? This is something which is maybe a little bit surprising. You know, we sort of all understand that having your, you know, child home from, because school is temporarily closed or on hiatus, you know, the daycare center is closed. Yeah, that makes sense. We kind of all understand that would probably require some modification. But even things like if you have, you know, the kids stay with grandma or your neighbor or some kind of somewhat informal, unlicensed arrangement, that may entitle the leave to be paid and to arise. It's a very wide net on that. So it's something to keep in mind. It's not as narrow, by the way, for the child care provider in place of care for the emergency sick leave as the FMLA the expanded FMLA standard for taking care of your own child. The FMLA provision is much more narrow than the child care provider being unavailable situation. So it's a little different there. What were you saying, Rich?
If there's like another parent, I can take care of it. Also, you have to be careful there with the expanded FMLA. So for instance, let's say there's two parents at home and both are trying to take leave to care for the children at home. That's a little bit tricky because if really only one parent needs to take care of the children, you can't have both parents trying to get, you know, paid expanded FMLA leave.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. So one other thing I wanted to go through quick, it's a little different, but it's pretty new. We've been getting a lot of questions. We'll go through this just for about 5 minutes here so people get a little more familiarity on it. It's part of a different set of programs that have been recently passed. It's called the Paycheck Protection Program. This is designed to enable forgivable loans to small businesses to help pay payroll. I know this is something a lot of small business owners are currently dealing with, the idea of I don't want to shut it down. So I don't really love the notion of laying everybody off. But since I don't have any revenue coming in or it's very limited, I don't have the option to be able to just keep paying paychecks every 2 weeks with money I don't have. This enables people to stay afloat. It is, again, it was originally set up as $349 billion. Frankly, that money's going to run out. But, you know, there may be some supplements on it. I believe upwards of, you know, more than 10% had already been accounted for in the first couple of days. This just went online, I believe, last Friday. Loan applications were coming in, and there were already, you know, massive, massive amounts of money being afforded on that. The long and short of that is it goes for, and again, it's small business. Just one other note. It's primarily for businesses up to 500. There are some narrow eligibility standards for businesses with over 500, but they have to meet Small Business Administration standards. Payroll, that's what it's for. You can get that money to pay your payroll, a little bit of mortgage, rent, utility costs, some of just kind of the operational costs. Couple of standards. You are capped at $100,000 on an annualized basis. And the...
For each employee.
Right, per person, that is. I'm sorry, thank you, yeah. So the idea being if someone is making $200,000 a year, the government is not going to loan you $200,000 to keep that person making that money. They'll cap it at 100. So what you can do sometimes, we've had this come up, is, you know, if you have someone making 120 and making 80, well, what might happen is you can fully fund the person making 80 for a certain period of time the person making 120 takes a haircut, but at least it keeps people working. And that's really the goal of this entire program. It's the other aspect of it is as long as you keep your payroll covered and you keep people working, the government will give you the money. They won't make you pay it back. Timelines, small businesses and proprietors were eligible to start applying last Friday, starting the 10th, which is this Friday. Independent contractors can start doing it. You're going to want to go through your most of your banks or small business lenders. It is only open through June 30th, 2020. That is subject to and assumes we don't have any new legislation, which we very well may. Couple of quick things. Again, this is just how you can spend the money. It's going to be capped at a certain number. Let's see, we have that. Here's where it can go wrong, though. And I want you to keep this in mind. You will owe money if you start spending the money on other things. You're pretty limited, so don't go making capital investments with this low interest loan. They will find that out. They will know that you're doing that. Also, if they start reducing wages by too much, that is to say, you can't just cut everybody's wages in half and then pretend that you get to keep all the money. That's not going to work. The idea is you're keeping people at where they were. And then you have to also, if you have cut your employees recently, you need to get them back on. Let me get the total amount of the loan. I have that in here and I do want to raise it. You are capped at, let me see. It's on the first. There it is. Sorry. It's the loan amount that you can get is up to 2 months of your average annual payroll cost plus 25% extra, subject to 10 million. So if your average monthly payroll costs are $50,000, your total average monthly, I'm sorry, your total loan amount would be that number of 50,000 times two plus 25%. So your total amount would be capped at $125,000 if you have $50,000 in monthly average payroll. The idea being, this is only designed to float businesses for the next couple of months. It's not designed to pay your payroll for the next year. This is just basically while COVID is in full shutdown mode, we're going to enable businesses to keep the lights on, but it's not a long-term solution. If it's extended through additional legislation, then obviously that might change the situation. And so, does anybody have any questions?
Tristan, we have a couple questions. Tristan and Rachel, we have a couple questions in the chat. The first one came from David, and he asked, if you have freelance employees, how can they obtain relief? Is that available? And David, feel free to unmute yourself as well.
Hi, guys. Video production company. I also work for an employer that works in television and media. 80% of our employees are freelancers, which means they may work one day a week. They may work 3 or 5 days a week. And that's all depending on their schedule. So I'm just trying to get the feedback from you guys in terms of how does that affect those employees that are on a freelance basis, not constantly employed, may work 1 week, may not work for 2 more weeks. How does that work with this plan?
Sure. So to be clear, they are actually they are employees. They're not independent contractors, correct?
They're W-2s, correct.
Beautiful. All right. It's good anyways. Back in the spring, we were spending all our time on AB5 and Dynamics issues and all that. So it was very, very common, those types of questions. So first off, the question is, do they qualify under any of the paid sick leave requirements in them or aspects in themselves? Again, are they on a individualized isolation order? Are they treating? Are they home with a child? First step, what do they apply under that? So, and again, we can talk specifics or not, but
let's say they're not. Let's say they just got laid off because the company has basically said, hey, we don't need you right now. Obviously, we're using the full-time staff to basically do what you guys did, essentially. Yeah. Because we've had reduced hours. So
Sure. So if what you're describing is a scenario where this is just a neat part of the economic downturn, the company could utilize some type of paycheck protection program if they wanted to do that to try to keep people working. If there was something to do, I mean, obviously we don't recommend, taking on those payroll loans if there's nothing to do. But if they had actually activities and the concern was just, slowdowns and you wanted to fill in the gap a little bit. Realistically, if they're fully healthy and the business is running and it's more of just a business downturn, other than the company going out of its way to take on loans to keep them working through, you know, paycheck protection or something like that, you're probably looking at just having them seek unemployment benefits to fill in the gaps. I mean, we've seen, and again, I hate to say that because it sounds very pessimistic, but what you're describing is the reason why there's been, 6 million unemployment claims last week and probably a comparable, if not higher number this week. It's just, if the work's not there, you're not going to be able to take much advantage of, kind of a paid sick leave provision. And again, they're not going to be eligible for paid sick leave if the situation is sort of an economic downturn caused by the pandemic, if they're not actually directly affected by it, from a health standpoint, so to speak, or caring for someone. If the business is running, the business is running. So probably their best avenue would be in the unemployment arena through the EDD. Where were you going to?
And I believe they've waived the 1 week waiting period for unemployment benefits, so they don't have to wait a week.
Right. Traditionally, you have a 1 week waiting period before you can seek before you can receive unemployment benefits. That's no longer in place, so they can get those benefits quickly. They are, of course, going to be quite a bit less than what people would see if they were traditionally working. I think the max is somewhere in the range of a few hundred dollars a week, but that's probably, unfortunately, where they're landing.
Great, thank you.
Of course.
So our next question in the chat came from Leo, and he asked, how is a forgivable loan different from a grant?
The difference is, if it's a grant, the money's yours, and there's, generally speaking, few strings attached. This is really structured like a traditional loan in the sense of there is interest that is accruing on it. You have a turnaround repayment plan. The idea is, it's going to be due within 2 years. Payments don't have to be made within for the first 6 months. But whereas a grant, there's no interest. You just, here's your money. Now you might have to follow certain requirements or be at risk of having to return it. But this is starting from the perspective that you will repay it. And if you do everything that the government wants you to do, they'll write it off, no questions asked. The problem that you would have on this is that if I have a small business and I, want to just sort of hire, give myself a $50,000 pay raise and then take a loan and have the government fund it, then that would be a pretty great trick to do. But of course, the state doesn't really like that. So, there are certain strings attached to it that, the federal government wants you to have the money and pay it to the employees, but at the same time, you have to stay within the parameters and use the money for what it's for. Otherwise, they want it back.
Thank you.
So those were the two questions in our chat, but I'm going to open it up to all our attendees. If you have any questions, please speak up. We have a few minutes until it is 3:00.
Maybe there are none.
Are you taking audio questions?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, I have one. I have a window cleaning business. It's not in Los Angeles, but it's in the Southern California area. I've had to lay off three of my technicians, so I've got one technician left and one admin. If by some chance either one of those people, while we're still kind of operating, decided to take off, say, the family leave, I don't have enough cash to support the amount of time that they would take off, because you said I'd have to pay even if we shut the doors. So basically, at this point, as an owner to get around that, I almost have to shut everything down and lay everybody off, and then nobody's eligible.
So there's a couple of things. One, if the description you're describing is probably the best possible application of the small business exception, the exemption on that. I mean, you're talking under 4 or 5 employees. You're talking about, a scenario where somebody's asking for paid sick leave that you just almost can't operate doing it that way and it's going to put too much distress. If that was going to apply, you know, what we say is for businesses with less than 50 employees where imposing the requirement would jeopardize the viability of the business, it's virtually exactly what you're describing. What you're describing is almost exactly what the exception is designed to address, which makes sense.
How many total employees are there?
I think, well, how many employees do you have? You think you said at this point, currently operating
I have five. Two left.
Two left. Yeah. I mean, this is just such a small number. You could explain if you have any thoughts, Rach, but I think you would be exempted from that sick leave just based on how few employees you're really looking at.
Right, because you just have to satisfy one of these three, which would be that providing leave would result in the small business's expenses and financial obligations exceeding available business revenues and cause the small business to cease operating at a minimal capacity, which would be one, or the absence of the employee would entail a substantial risk to the financial health or operational capabilities of the business because of their specialized skills, knowledge, or responsibilities. Or there are not sufficient workers who are able, willing, and qualified, and who will be available at the time and place needed to perform the labor or services provided. So basically, if any of those three exist, then you can be exempt from providing the expanded FMLA leave.
You would want to document how, you know, kind of what the situation is, try to keep some kind of rough numbers as to what's going on were that to arise. But frankly, I wouldn't. I think you have the best possible scenario of any you almost could put together on paper as to why you would be exempted.
And what the Department of Labor has stated on its website is if to elect this small business exemption, you would want a document that a determination has been made pursuant to the criteria that I read earlier, and that you don't need to send in forms to the Department of Labor or anything like that, but you want to keep records that, you know, that you're electing the exemption.
Yeah, it's a little bit like a lot of employers deal. We see it almost with the interactive process when looking at reasonable accommodations, in the sense of you want to show that you took the thoughtful analysis, you evaluated the numbers and the data and what's on the table, and didn't just kind of willy-nilly say, nah, you know, we're not even going to look at it. If you do that, it doesn't look like it's a really thoughtful assessment. And so the federal government might look a little bit more harshly at that. But again, if what you're describing is the circumstance, I would feel like you'd have a pretty good contention that you just exempt based on the risk to the organization.
So how would you file the exemption?
Well, you don't really file it. You just kind of document it internally. And then if the situation ever arises where you need to explain what happened or that they reached out on it, but you don't submit sort of an exemption form to the DOL.
So then you inform the employee that they, for the reasons that we're talking about, that they can't get the sick pay, and then just have the documentation?
Right. Yeah, that's going to be basically what it is. You know, we're not, in the same way that when people reach out to you about FMLA, I don't know if it's happened before, if you don't have 50 employees, you don't have to send something to the state or the government that says, you know, we don't have 50 employees. You just kind of advice, you know, we're exempt under this criteria.
It's only going to apply to the child care.
For both. Yeah, for this. Well, that's just for the child care. I guess if they're just ill, but I think what you're talking about is more a scenario of child care, right? If they're just ill and they can't work. You understand what I'm getting at?
That's true. Based on the people that are left, we probably have enough to pay their 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, the extended, the 10 extra weeks is only for childcare anyways, and that's exactly what the exemption is used for small businesses. It has to only be for the childcare, and that's for both. That's for both the emergency sick leave and the emergency FMLA. So basically, to get exemption for small businesses under both of those, it would need to be because the school or childcare provider of the employee's child is closed or unavailable. And that's what you'd be exempting them from. You'd be exempting them from leave for that purpose.
The other thing too you might find is you could kind of merge things together a little bit. If you were in a pinch and thought you needed it, you could also look at getting a Paycheck Protection Program loan to potentially fund that, because leave payments for people for payroll can actually be covered in that. So you might find that you kind of mesh these two items together. and utilize some kind of loan activity that could be forgiven as long as you keep the person on the roster for the requisite period of time, take the money from the government, sort of pass it along, so to speak, and then have it written off later. That's another thing you could look at to kind of, again, sort of tying the pieces here together.
I've already applied for that, actually.
Okay, good. Yeah.
And something else to keep in.
Just real quick.
Please.
Having just applied for it, I just quick comment. There is still a lot of confusion in the marketplaces. Chase, for one, even though they're an SBA lender, Wells Fargo, even though they're an SBA lender, has chosen not to take applications just because of some of the other issues they had legally a while back. Chase is a big bank. For whatever reason, they're holding up sending in applications. My SBA lender just opened up today because apparently they keep changing the rules about how to calculate things and all that, which it is 2.5 times the amount of your average payroll. And then you can also add the $10,000 that you would get if you apply for the SBA disaster loan and roll it in there as well.
Yeah. And what's kind of notable about that too is, you know, and thank you. I appreciate that insight on that, that it's, you know, the kind of mess. One thing that's come up a lot without getting too much into banking regulations is there's been a lot of concerns about the bank, about what kind of exposure and protection they have. If, you know, if I walk in and say, you know, I have all these, you know, payroll, you know, requirements that I need to meet, here's my information. The bank hands me a loan, you know, an SBA government funded loan for, you know, however much over the months, you know, $300,000. And then I just take off with the money and I'm gone. Is the bank going to be held responsible for not adequately vetting that? You know, kind of what kind of background check do they need to do? What kind of financial resources check? You know, how much this is fair? Because obviously the goal is you want to get the money out quick. But on the other hand, the bank doesn't want to be held responsible for, you know, handing out loans to anybody who walks in with a spreadsheet. And then, you know, the federal government looks at them and say, well, why'd you give that person, you know, all this money? And you know, there's understandably some apprehension about how this would work and the timeline on that, but it's a fair concern.
Great. So I know we're a couple minutes past 3. I spoke with Tristan and Rachel, and they said they have until 3:15 to answer questions. Does that still stand, you guys?
Sure. That's absolutely fine.
So we have a few minutes to answer a few questions if anyone has any. So if you guys have to go, we understand. Thank you for joining. But if you have questions, please, still.
Maybe not.
All right. Well, look, there are no more questions. I want to say thank you to both of you, Tristan and Rachel. We appreciate you coming online and sharing all this information. There's so many new laws and changes happening. So it really is super valuable to everyone that we get updates on all these things. David, you have a question?
Just a quick question. How do you keep up with all that? If it keeps changing day to day, how do you keep, how do you take all this in and know how to decipher all of it?
Dave, we work a lot of hours.
Yeah, and at first when these started to come out, they were very unclear, and the Department of Labor's answers to certain questions have been very informative. So I think as it's evolving, we're getting more clarification, and then the answers are becoming more clear to us.
Yeah, that's really true. I mean, one of the things, the pattern that tends to keep happening is you get this huge, you know, whatever this was, $2 trillion relief bill or however it came down. And it's got, you know, a million provisions and, you know, a billion here and a billion there. And then a week or so passes and then you start getting advisements from the various, you know, executive, you know, divisions, you know, the Department of Labor. And they'll explain, well, here's what this all means. Here's how this is supposed to work. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as the gentleman with the, you know, talking about the loans have indicated, a lot of this stuff is fairly uncertain, you know, and that's, I wish there was more clarity on this, but that's what ends up happening is, you know, you try to, you know, have a super complicated problem solved overnight and it's just not going to happen. So, you know, we try to stay on top of these things as they come up with each little bit. The other problem too, of course, with California is that, you know, we will have our, I mean, we work out of LA and San Diego, and so you'll have your LA regulations as well. You have California add-ons, you have the San Diego region has its own different types of legislation that passes. You know, they had one that everybody in a public-facing job has to have a face mask now. And, you know, these things kind of mesh into it and who provides it. It's, you know, just try to do your best to stay on top of it. But you guys know how it is as business owners. It's right. Always a challenge to stay on the right side of it. And of course, this, the downside for being on the wrong side of a really even narrow issue is always heavy. And I wish it wasn't that way, but it's kind of how these things are drawn up.
Yeah. And like, for instance, when the Emergency Family Medical Leave Expansion Act was passed, a lot of people thought that that was going to be on top of regular FMLA leave, which has now been clarified. And now we know that it comes out of the 12 weeks total. Yeah. So things are becoming more clear to us as we proceed. And of course, if anyone has any questions after this, you can also email us.
Yeah, I believe the contact info is on the slide that's forward facing now. If not, obviously let us know. There's the website at any time. You can reach out to us as well and get any specific details. So,
great. Well, again, you guys, thank you so much for joining the second presentation I've worked on Tristan with, and it's a pleasure working with you. And I also want to give a shout out to Robert, who's on the call, for helping organize this with PettitCon. And thank you guys again.
All right. Thanks so much. Take care, folks.
Thank you.